of an open, like, question-answer discussion time. Is that okay? Is that okay? Is that okay with all the birthday girls? Because I'm sure that all the basic things that I could say you already know. Right? Why don't we go through what we already know? Now she's telling secrets. Typical, girls have to tell secrets at a birthday party. Didn't your mom ever tell you it was rude to tell secrets in front of other people? I learned that when I was a little kid. Okay, why don't we use a typical educational technique here? And I'll first ask you guys, so what do you know about the concept of rule?
Nothing.
I don't believe it. Beat her up. Come on, somebody. What do you know? Okay, we'll give you 30 spankings. What do you know? Come on, what do you guys know already? About guru. About guru. Yeah.
You know.
Okay, we'll start with you. Abu, he knows.
Basically, what I'm saying to you is, what I'm referring to is the external expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's his manifestation that we can see, and through him we can go see God. When I'm actually the boat wire, the guy who rides the boat.
The guy who drives the boat. Okay, so if he's the external representation of God, does that mean he's God?
No, he's not God. We respect him.
What's the difference between guru and God? Can you ask me? Well, quantity, but give me some specifics. What's the difference? It's a very important thing to understand.
The guru is a teacher, and God is like the same.
Well, God's also a teacher. Krishna in your heart is definitely teaching. He's external manifestation of super soul, but what's the difference?
He repeats what Krishna says.
That's what's the same. Krishna says, and he repeats what Krishna says.
Guru is a person, like a human, like us, but, you know.
Yeah, okay. So he's a jiva. He's a spirit soul. Mm-hmm. Well, how does that manifest? What are the differences that manifest between guru and God? Very important. You know why it's so important? Because a lot of, even though we say philosophically that the guru is not God, we find that many, many times, devotees deal with their guru and expect things from their guru as if their guru was God. And then they become very disappointed, and then they have faith problems. Just like in the material world, everybody, every materially conditioned soul is trying to find someone who will be God to them, and they're trying to play God to somebody. So they're trying to play God to their dog, or to their spouse, or to their children. And they're expecting that their spouse or their employer or their parents or their dog will be God to them. And this is the reason that people get so frustrated. If you expect that your wife or your husband is going to be God, they can't be God. So then when they can't fulfill all of your desires and fully reciprocate with you and be everything you want them to be, then you become disappointed. Does that make sense? So what happens often in spiritual life is we transfer that illusion to guru. And we think that now the guru is going to be God for me. And I see this a lot in the Hare Krishna movement. That people have, they put expectations on the guru that are not shastric. Either philosophical expectations or often emotional expectations. And then when the guru doesn't meet those expectations, then they lose faith. Either they lose faith in that particular guru, or they lose faith in the process in general. Does that make sense? I see it all the time.
I think a lot of the time, many people have this whole celebrity sense with gurus. And
yes.
If a particular guru has a particular attractive quality, then they're drawn to that.
Yes.
And only that quality, not necessarily.
Yes, they're often looking at the material quality. Whereas we're told in Nectar of Instruction that you don't judge a person even if they have a diseased or infirm or ugly body. He said even if those qualities appear very prominent, still you don't judge on that basis. But yeah, everybody has some material, all of us, everybody has some materially good quality. And one may mistake that for the spiritual. But also I think we've developed in general, a kind of celebrity cult for people who give diksha, which is not, first of all, the only kind of guru that there is. But we definitely have done that. We've kind of made them into, you know, spiritual rock stars. And it puts a very undue burden on the people doing that service, and it also creates, again, non-shastric expectations and mentality in the devotees in general, which always end up being harmful. You know, in the long run, they always end up harming people. So what are the differences between guru and guru? Yeah?
Based on that, guru just speaks what Krishna says, and not any. As soon as you say something that God has not said, he's a fake guru.
Well, so does that mean that all you can do is read the verses in the Bhagavad Gita and you're not allowed to ask what time it is because Krishna didn't ask what time it is? Okay, well, what does that mean? Prabhupada also said we should speak according to our own realization. And you present the truth according to time, place, and circumstance. So, I mean, if you say guru is just someone who says exactly what God says and you take that literally, then that would mean all you can do is like read Bhagavad Gita. And you can never open your mouth to say anything else other than the Bhagavad Gita. You can just say the Bhagavad Gita verses.
Guru is also to kind of adapt the philosophy so that we can apply it in the best way for ourselves.
Not just prerogative, but actually that's the duty of the guru, is to apply Krishna's teachings. I mean, Krishna's also applying from within the heart. Krishna's also personalizing. And as one gets more and more realized, then one's relationship with Krishna is also very personal. But in other words, one is not teaching any principles or truth other than what Krishna. One's not making up one's own philosophy of life. That's, when Prabhupada says that, that's what he's talking about. He's not saying that, you know, you can only say the exact words. But still, you're not telling me a difference. What's the difference between guru and goddess? I don't hear any difference in that.
Guru is not infallible.
Okay, well, guru is not infallible in the same sense that Krishna is not infallible. In what sense? Give me a sense in which the infallibility is different. Okay, so the guru is a jiva, and any jiva has the capability of falling under Maya, whereas Krishna never falls under the control of Maya. Krishna does fall in love with Radharani, but that's how Krishna falls in love with Radharani. He falls under the control of Mother Yasoda. And so it kind of falls to Krishna. We say that, right? Fall in love? Krishna fall, that's Krishna's only kind of fall down, that he falls in love with all his devotees. But yeah, any jiva can always, there's the capability of fall down is never taken away, otherwise we would be stoned. So any jiva has the capability of turning from Krishna. Something else besides our guys, the girls are all just like,
no.
Come on.
Guru has a guru.
A guru has a guru. Of course Krishna also takes a guru.
The guru is the controller.
That Krishna is the supreme controller. How does that manifest, though? Give me something practical. Yes?
Probably on jiva or something that is good, he realizes the background where we're trying to, you know, get full consciousness about the existence of God.
So you're comparing guru with ourselves.
And with God itself, he's God.
So, but there are some gurus who are Nitya Siddha devotees who have not gone through a process to realize God. Just like, I assume you've never been to prison, you've never been arrested. You never know. Well, but so, you haven't had to go through some process of reformation to become a good citizen. You've been a good citizen since you were born. I mean, maybe you committed some petty crimes, like you drove too fast on the highway or something. Maybe you stole a candy when you were 5 years old. But basically, you're a good citizen. So you don't have, there's nothing you have to do to be a good citizen. You just keep on doing what you're doing. But if someone's committed a crime and they've been to jail, they have to go through some period of rectification before they can become a good citizen again. Now, the idea is that once they go through that period of rectification, that they're as good of a good citizen as anyone else. Now, of course, I know in America, once you've committed a felony, you're permanently banned from certain, like you can never vote. Once you've ever committed a felony, you're considered permanently different from everybody else. But with Krishna, it's not like that. So there's some pure devotees that they've always been pure devotees. They've never fallen away from Krishna. And all they have to do is just keep doing what they're doing. And others who have become, like I assume most of us, who have fallen into illusion and have become perfect through the process of sadhana bhakti. But once you become perfect, you're perfect. And once you become perfect, you realize your eternal relationship with Krishna, and it's as if you never left. There is some difference, though, in the manifestation of the body and Prarabdha Karma, but that's a very complex subject. What other differences are there between Guru and Guru?
A Guru gives more of his mercy more readily than Krishna would to us.
Oh, I like that. Yes, because Krishna is neutral. We're saying external manifestation of super soul. Super soul is the manifestation of Krishna that's totally neutral and objective. Completely neutral in your chakra. Whereas the Guru, or any Vaishnava, is discriminating and saying, this person is receptive, this person is not receptive, I'll give my mercy to someone who's receptive. And sometimes a pure devotee gives mercy to someone even who's not receptive, but that's very rare. And generally that shouldn't be anything. Like when Nityananda gave mercy to Jagannatha, but that's unusual. But yes, and then Krishna's mercy follows the mercy of the devotee. There's one way, though, in which Krishna is more merciful than the devotee. No, in general. Krishna is in our heart, and he stays in our heart. He never leaves. He never rejects us under any conditions. So if even we become a demon, or we become, you know, a tarantula, or a scorpion, or a shark, or something like that, Krishna always stays with us, and he always loves us. But the Guru can, and in fact, under some situations, is obligated to reject the disciple.
He's not following Krishna's teachings.
No, there are certain situations under which a guru is obligated to reject the disciple. Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, if under the circumstances the guru doesn't reject the disciple, both the disciple and the guru go to hell. One of the offenses is to preach the holy name to the faithless. So if a guru gives the holy name to someone who's faithless,
I think it's like someone who's faithless.
So sometimes, although the guru tries their best, sometimes they may inadvertently give the holy name to someone who's faithful. In which case, it's their duty to renounce that to someone. Publicly, Bhaktivinoda Thakura says. So the relationship with the guru can be cut off, but the relationship with Krishna can never be cut off. It is possible. Somebody can cut off their relationship with their guru. And the guru can cut off the relationship with the disciple. But that's impossible to happen. You cannot cut off your relationship with Krishna.
Can you choose your guru is going to be? You can't choose your God.
That's nice. You can't say, well, I think I'd like Durga to be God. That's nice. I never thought.
And also, guru is more distant than God is. However, we actually think that vice versa.
Yes, that's a good point, actually. And because of that, you can't say that although Guru is the external representation of Super Soul, it's not necessarily that your Guru knows every single thing that you're thinking. The Guru knows whatever information Krishna chooses to give him, but it doesn't. The Guru is not omniscient the way God is omniscient. This is very important. I mean, it's not that the Guru is in every atom. Okay, that was a lovely class. That was watch the lights on the ring. I don't even know how to turn it off. So it really is extremely important that the guru is not omniscient like God. Not. He doesn't know every desire and every thought of every living being all over the world. Now, Krishna can give him that information. Krishna even gives ordinary people sometimes the ability to predict the future in so many things. But not necessarily so.
There's much more hidden than God.
More hidden?
Exactly. their part is the start in God, because God is in the scripture, in his name, in his form, etc.
Alright, but you can see the guru physically walking around on the earth.
I know he can.
You don't may not recognize. We have the same problem with God, inability to recognize him, so I'm not sure. It's interesting. That you're worth exploring.
No, going back to what you said, that the guru doesn't know everything. But he knows, like a lot of people say that, you know, that his disciples say he knows what's going on there and why he sees right through you. And
maybe, sometimes. I wouldn't assume that as an absolute given.
And that's why he bases his decisions on tells you what to do, when to do it, because he knows two things.
Another misconception is that if I follow the instructions of Krishna, or if I follow the instructions of Guru, that everything in my life will be materially happy. I see this doesn't even work with Krishna's instructions. It's not that if you follow Krishna's instructions that you'll never have any pain or suffering or difficulty in your life. Well, I don't know, quite the opposite either. That's not fair. But it's not exactly like that. I mean, let's say that you wanted to get in really good physical shape and you went to a trainer, you know, and they gave you a series of exercises and diet and a program to do. It's not that it would all just be fun. It would achieve your goal of getting in shape, but some of the process might be painful. Right? Or many of you are in school, correct? So you're going to school to get a degree. But the process is not always pleasant. And sometimes your teacher may come and say, hey, you need to do this, and you need to fix this, and right? But if you want the goal of getting an education, then you may also have to take some austerity. Hopefully it's not all austerity. And if you're fixed on the goal, then you're not going to find it as painful. Then you're seeing how what you're going through relates to the goal. But it's not like, you know, that if Prabhupada approved a marriage, that necessarily they were just going to be, you know, totally in love with each other forever. People thought like this. They thought, well, if I ask Prabhupada to approve my marriage, that it must be that this person is just the perfect person for me and we'll never have an argument and it'll just be like heaven all the time. That's a bunch of bunk. No, so it's not like that. And I mean, and there are very, very few gurus who are who are micromanaging their disciples' lives.
A guru is meant to be a teacher, so bearing in mind that he might not know you that well, how can you guide you?
That's a very good question. And there's many different kinds of gurus, aren't there? So, unfortunately, the system that has evolved in ISKCON at the present moment is such that we have far too few gurus, and many of them have far less of a personal relationship with their disciples than is ideal. So what ended up happening is the main way people are getting guidance is from other persons, whom they may or may not accept as Shiksha gurus. That's not the tradition to have things work like that, and hopefully it will not be like that forever. But most disciples find that the kind of instructions they get from their guru are general ones, unless they happen to deal closely with their spiritual master.
How do you become a guru if you choose?
Are you talking about how should it work, or are you talking about how does it work? What's your question? Is your question what is the Shastric system, or is your question what's the particular institutional system that exists in ISKCON at the moment, because they're not the same thing?
The Shastric system.
The Shastric system. Which is not the way it works in ISKCON at the moment. The Shastric system is if your guru is present, your guru may say to you, I would like you also to become guru. I'd like you also to take disciples. Just like that's not the whole answer. That may happen. Just like you're in school and the teacher says to you, there's someone over there that needs help, would you please go and help them? Would you become an assistant teacher? Okay? Or it may happen that, you know, somebody comes to you and says, will you teach me? Will you guide me? And then if your guru is still personally present, you go to your guru and say, someone's asked me to help them. Can I do that? Again, you're in a school and you're a senior student. You're in your last year of school or something. And there's a need for tutors. And some students come to you and they say, well, I noticed that you're really, really good in whatever. I've watched you in class and you're really good in history. Would you tutor me in history because I'm having a hard time? And then you might go to the professor and say, somebody's asking me to tutor them in history. Is that all right? And your professor might say, well, I don't really think that's a good idea. You know, you're not really that good. I think you should wait a little bit. Or the professor might say, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for helping me. Then there's also in a school, at a certain point you graduate and you get your certificate that you can also be a teacher. Yeah? Just like when I got my PhD, that it's understood that once you get a PhD, you can become a college professor. Now, still, a college has to hire you. A university has to hire you. But it's understood that then you have the qualification. So that's, how is that determined? Suppose your own teacher is no longer present. So then one has to be mature. One has to be spiritually mature. So it's expected that every disciple is going to become guru. That's the expectation. The expectation is that everyone in the PhD program graduates and can themselves become a professor. That's the idea. Now, many people graduate and never become professors. Maybe they're qualified, but they just don't do that job. They do some other job. Some people don't graduate. So one should be mature. So how does one know that? One consults with senior Vaishnavas. And one may understand oneself. Just like a Prabhupada had an order from his guru to preach in English to English-speaking people. And Prabhupada understood that order to mean that he was supposed to take disciples. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati never said to him specifically, you should take disciples. But he understood that. Once Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was no longer present, and the Prabhupada was preaching, then naturally he would also train those people as his disciples. And he certainly had been, many of his god brothers certainly also encouraged him to preach. So that's the Shastric system. It's a very informal system.
Just on those points, from what I understood, Prabhupada gave the mandate that it's the responsibility of every single member of ISKCON to be guru.
Yes.
As in, Shiksha Guru gave whatever you've learned, share it with others.
Well, and both. Then, both. And both.
And Diksha.
Both.
But in the presence of their guru, Diksha Guru, etiquette would be.
Unless we find, although Prabhupada said that several times, if you look at historically, you'll find that many, many people gave diksha in the physical presence of their diksha guru. In fact, that was very common. And one can understand that from several reasons. That first of all, people didn't have the kind of communication system and travel system that we have now. So if your guru sent you to another village or country or something to preach, it would be very difficult to bring prospective disciples back to your guru. So often a guru would ask mature disciples, you go now and make disciples. It was very common. And if you just look historically at the tradition, it was actually more common that a person would take disciples in the physical presence of while their guru was physically on the planet than not. But that would have, then the guru would have to give you the direct order to do that. In other words, you couldn't just do that. That's exactly like you're in a class and your teacher's right there physically in the class. So you're not just going to go help people without the teacher's permission. But that can happen either way. Either the guru says, I want you to start making disciples. Or people are approaching you and saying, I'd like to learn from you. And then you go to your guru and say, people are asking me, what do I do? Now that happened when Prabhupada was on the planet. That he sent some disciples very early in the movement to India. And people approached them and said, I'd like to become your disciple. And they wrote back to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, the etiquette is you don't do this in the presence of your guru. Now we can understand, though, Prabhupada also could see they weren't mature. And we're talking about people who've been devotees a year or two.
When Prabhupada goes back to India, and then the devotees are thinking they'll go to others,
That's right.
Response at that time.
That's right.
My position was to save them.
That's right.
You know,
that's exactly. Exactly. But Prabhupada many, many times would say, not only in the context of giving shiksha, but also in the context of giving diksha, he would say that the system of succession will go on. I mean, one of the times when Prabhupada was really talking about everyone becoming guru was at his Vyas Puja. Yeah, and he was specifically talking about the system of succession going on. So there's no doubt that Prabhupada wanted everybody to become guru. And that would mean either shiksha or diksha or both. Now, not that he expected that that would necessarily happen.
Which shiksha he expected? He said even if a child all they know is, you know, or if all you know is prasad is nice and you share it, that's shiksha in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, but he also did expect the other. I mean, there's one famous talk in Mayapur where he said, you know, now we have 10,000, so if each of you go and make them, we'll have 100,000. He definitely expected that. He definitely wanted that. I mean, he said it over and over and over and over and over again.
What was that? When did he become a guru?
If you go to dandavats.com, click on archives, and there's a nice paper there. Okay. Yes.
Can you become something and not attend and then not attempt to go down to this compulsory final? Initiation, possibly.
Then not what?
And then go down to this compulsory, you know, initiation. Just say, for instance, I know devotee that if he becomes a disciple by miracle, he becomes a Babaji. And he's not going to get initiation as well. So, is that okay?
I don't understand.
Basically, I mean, right now, I don't, you know.
So we have people who aren't sannyasis who have disciples.
What if they're not giving initiation
and diksha? I don't understand. You mentioned Ayendra Prabhu is not a diksha guru, isn't taking that responsibility.
Okay.
Giving
so what if you accept someone who's not giving diksha as your guru?
Yeah.
Well, if they won't give you diksha, then you can't take diksha from them, they have to give it to you. I'm confused.
So you have to get diksha, why can't you just accept the guru?
Why can't you just have shiksha without diksha? Is that your question?
Yeah.
Okay, but that's, so I'm giving you two different questions. First of all, do you have to be a sannyasi to be a guru? The resounding answer is no. Okay. Would you be willing to accept Hanuman as your guru? If Hanuman, the Hanuman appeared before you, would you accept him as your guru? I would think so, right? Would you? Yeah, but I mean, is there anything wrong with his qualifications to be a guru? Well, he's not even human. What to speak of a sannyasi? I'm just speaking that the qualification for guru is not dependent on the body. It's not dependent on anything external. There's a very nice verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita, which Prabhupada quotes in relationship to women being gurus. It has nothing to do with the body. So nothing to do with, you know, are you a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra? Are you a brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas? Are you old, young? Are you male, female? Are you even human or not human? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I'm at full.
So that's...
Say if I accept you as my guru and you accept me as your...
Disciple.
Yeah. I accept you as my guru and you accept me as your disciple.
Yeah.
Then, and you don't go on to give a diksha.
Then
you still go get diksha.
Yes, that's another question.
Do you go to the spiritual world of why?
No, but generally.
Why?
That's a very good question. So, Prabhupada compares diksha, in other words, why do you need diksha at all? Why isn't siksha sufficient? So, Prabhupada compares getting diksha, do any of you know what, in the university?
Registration.
Registration in the university. So do you need to register in a university in order to get an education? No. What benefit do you get by registering in a university? What benefit do you get by being an officially enrolled student in a university? Oh, and do some people get degrees without ever having enrolled in a university? Yeah, they do. Sometimes the university gives honorary degrees. Nowadays they do it mostly to donors, you know, but I mean... It used to be that an honorary degree And so now, like job applications, it'll say an earned doctorate specifically, because honorary degrees have become a joke. But it used to be that honorary degrees were given to somebody who had demonstrated that they had the knowledge in another way. And I wish I should look this up, because I give this example and I should know. There was in America, before black people were accepted into medical colleges, there was one black man who really wanted to be a medical doctor. And because they wouldn't let him into a medical college, he became the apprentice of a doctor. And he studied under him, and he became so expert that he wasn't allowed to do surgery, but he would go into the surgery room, the operating room, and he would advise the doctors. And he developed many new techniques of healing people. I forget his name, but there's a statue of him, I believe, in Harvard and the university. Now, in those days, he never actually got his medical degree, but believe me, he was more than a doctor. He was more knowledgeable than the doctors. So, yes, it is certainly sometimes possible to get full spiritual knowledge without diksha. The holy name does not depend on diksha. Krishna is independent. Sukadeva Goswami never took diksha, and he was a perfectly realized soul in Krishna praying. Jed Barrett, in his third life, did not take diksha. Of course, he remembered his guru from his other life. He would chant his Gayatri mantra backwards and stuff. And he was pure in love with Krishna. So it's certainly possible. The holy name is not dependent on anything, and Krishna is independent also. But why do we enroll in a university? What benefits do you get? You get credibility.
To
use the facilities.
To get discipline.
Discipline.
So that they have you in their database.
They have you in their database, yes. What else?
If you get lost, they can reconnect you.
They can reconnect you, okay. What else? What benefit do you get? How many of you here either are enrolled or have been enrolled in university? Vast majority. Why'd you do it? Why didn't you just read books?
Mom made me.
Your mom made you. There you go. What makes it easy?
Guidance. Teaching.
Why couldn't you get that guidance if you weren't enrolled? It's much more difficult, isn't it? So when you enroll, then every professor in the university is there to serve you, right? Not just the person who enrolled you. You don't just have to, it's not just your admissions officer. The Diksha Guru is like a college admissions officer. It's not just that your admissions officer and your academic advisor are helping you. All the professors are. And you get a little ID card. I think I still have my ID card. And then you can use the library. You get a number, right? And then everyone recognizes that you're a student. Yes, isn't it? You're making a commitment to the university, and the university is making a commitment to you. That's why all the professors and the library and everything is at your disposal. Because you've made a commitment. And the admissions officer especially has made a commitment. The admission officer has basically said to the institution, I vouch for this person. I think this person has a really good chance of graduating. I've looked over this person's record, I've interviewed them, I've read their essays, and I think this person is sincere about getting an education. If the admissions officer admits too many people that drop out, then he's going to get yelled at by his superiors, right? The admissions officer is supposed to screen people so that the resources of the institution are not wasted on insincere persons. Oh, okay. That you know that your degree is going to mean something. And then you know, once I'm accepted, that if I just follow the program and graduate, the dean of the university is going to sign my diploma. If you're just studying on your own, you don't know if you're going to get an honorary degree or not. Chances are you're not. a big gamble. You don't have any protection. Nobody feels obligated to give you any guidance. They might not. You might call up a professor at university, a law professor, and say, I have a legal problem. Maybe they'll help you out. Maybe they won't. But if you're a student there, they're obligated to help you out. So when you take Diksha, just like we get our little ID card, so we get a little ID card, we get a name. Now you're Varshana Devi again. That's your, it's just like your little, you know, ID number. And just like in the university, they have their little mascots and they have their, right, their sweatshirts with their little signs on it. So we get our, this tilak means not only that I'm a servant of Krishna, but it means that I'm part of a particular school. I'm part of a particular sampradaya. And then we get our tulsi. These are our little ID cards. Seriously, that's what they are. They're our university ID cards. Our tulsi beads, our tilak, our name. That allows us, and then we become recognized. That means you're not only recognized by your Diksha Guru, you're recognized by all of the sampradaya. All of the other professors, all the other transcendental professors in the sampradaya, then accept you. You can get help from any of them. Not only the ones who are on the planet, but even the ones who are no longer on the planet. Then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srimad Prabhupada, Narada Muni. You become a student of all of them. And then you you've got a guarantee, if you follow their program, that Krishna, who's the dean of the whole thing, will sign you to. Otherwise it's not very safe. And although the holy name is already pure, the idea of initiation is that the guru asks Krishna to be present in the holy name. Like, you ever see those phone cards at the shop that have to be activated? If you just steal one, they won't work. Right? You ever see that? Do they have them in the UK? You buy phone cards and it says must be activated to work. So the mantra, of course, the Hare Krishna mantra is independent. It's there even without Diksha. But the holy name is a person. And when the guru says, yes, I put my name on the line for this, you know, I vouch for Kushal. I vouch for him. I think he's a good guy. I think you should let him in, Krishna. And Krishna says, well, I don't know, but because you said so, all right. I'll accept it. Then your card gets activated. And Krishna says, all right, I'll appear in the holy name for this person. Because you said so. It says to the group. You follow? It's a commitment. It's sort of like asking the question, why get married? And many people are asking that question. Why not just live together? Why bother? Why not, you know, just we'll just live together. I'll just have a string of boyfriends and girlfriends one after another. Why bother with marriage? I was just reading this nice article about all the research as to the benefits of marriage for children, for the adults who get married, and for society. And how married people live longer, are healthier, etc., etc., etc. Just not even looking at the kids. It said for men, they're happier and live longer and are healthier no matter what kind of marriage they have. For women, it's only true if it's not a horrible marriage. It's a little different. So they were listing all these, I mean, empirical research studies showing that people who were married were happier. And it was especially comparing not just married to single people, but married people to people who lived together. That there was much higher rates, you know, like 10 times as high rates of domestic violence in when people were just living together than when they were married, for example. I mean, a whole list of things. You know, people were much more likely to abuse intoxicants, get involved in crime, etc., when they weren't married, just when they were married. And people will say, well, we don't have to get married. You know, this has become very common now with the modern celebrities. They're just living together, right? They even have children together. And they say, we don't need a paper, we don't need to take vows, we know we love each other. But the research shows that when people live like that, they're much more likely to be unhappy and diseased and addicted to intoxicants and criminals and so many things. Now, why, that's a whole other discussion. But the point is that there is a value to making a commitment. There's some meaning to that. We want Krishna to make a commitment to us. We make a commitment to him, you know, duh. Why in the world should Krishna make a commitment to us if we're not willing to make a commitment to him? Yeah.
Just a few points. Firstly, based on the analogy you gave of the whole university system, sometimes we find that certain courses we take end up being badly organized, badly taught, badly funded, so many things. Mm-hmm. So the course itself is not accredited to the same degree we might expect initially. So the course fails, essentially. So taking that into the back to the group, sometimes we find that we have this fear that maybe that can happen to us when we have a group.
Well, it depends if you're looking also at Shiksha or Diksha. Because the, although a Diksha guru can be both a Diksha and a Shiksha guru, the functions are somewhat different. A Diksha guru can be only a Diksha guru and not at all a Shiksha guru. That's possible. That's unusual. But it's certainly unusual in this one, but it's possible. So what you're looking for in a Diksha guru is just like, what are you looking for in a college admissions officer? It's very simple. Yeah, that's it. So when you hand them your money, they're not putting it in their pocket. Pretty simple. That, who said date, you said you get your name in the database? Did you say that? That when your admissions officer enters your name in the database that you're enrolled, that you're actually entered in the university's database, it's not just the guy's personal computer. Could you imagine if, you know, the admissions officer says, yes, you got into Cambridge, and you get all excited, you think you got into Cambridge and you paid your admissions fee, they usually have an admissions fee, right? And you got your acceptance letter, and you find out that the guy's just a phony, he's just working for himself. And the admissions letter is in fact, you know, you go to the college and they say, you know, the university, and they say, sorry, this guy doesn't work for us. He was a con man. And you're not in our system. We never got your money, and you're not in our system. So for a Diksha guru, it's very, very, very simple. Are they representing Krishna? So how do you tell that? First of all, are they in the parampara? Do they have a guru in parampara? Or are they just setting up shop on their own? Are they following? Are they a good disciple? A good guru for sure has to be a good disciple. Are they following? Like you're saying, are they saying what Krishna says? Just like the university has its policy booklet. So is the guru handing you the university's policy booklet, or have they made up their own? Right? So Prabhupada's policy booklet is 4 regulative principles, 16 rounds. So is the guru teaching that, or are they teaching something else? Are they teaching, no, only, you know, 2 rounds and 1 regulative principle, sleep until 11. You know, what policy booklet they give you? You follow?
The reason why I asked was previously you said you gave an idea of how a PhD student can become a professor themselves.
Yes.
Whereas that qualification is something very external and can be measured by other people. Whereas the qualification to be good doesn't necessarily.
Well, what is it? It's interesting. I was just having this talk with a devotee in Italy. And did you get me a glass of water? That in the Nectar of Instruction, where it talks about how to deal with different people, it gives the requirements, and you notice those requirements for the different levels. Anyone know what they are? How do you judge Kanistha, Majjhima, and Uttama? The Nectar of Instruction. Not Nectar of Instruction. That's other places. No, certainly never. Never. Probably just blindfolding. That's Nectar, that's Isha Pasha. That's blind following. Okay, Prabhupada specifically says blind following is condemned, and he defines blind following as, oh, this guru has many disciples, he must be blind following. It's not that somebody who has only one disciple is less bona fide than somebody who has 5 million, billion, quadrillion disciples. There's lots of followers of, what's some movie star, that stuff.
Well, the Nishtha says,
so many people come to the Rolling Stones concerts, doesn't mean that they're
One who thinks, oh, just my way is the one who loves.
That's not a nectar of instruction. That's an Isha Upanishad, a nectar devotion. What's a nectar of instruction?
How much faith is there?
No, it's not there.
What is
that's the first verse. But how do we distinguish between Kanista, Majjhima, and Uttama? Not in Upadeshamrita.
How do you see other people for...
That's not Upadeshamrita. That's other places.
How many people convert to Vaishnavism?
Whether he's converting a lot of people to Vaishnavism is also mentioned there in that purport. But what are the main demarcations?
Is it
not to
do with how well he knows
science
Krishna
conscious? That's other places.
Okay, Caleb? Copy? You want to keep that?
Okay. I'll keep it. It's your turn. I'll frame it. That's not there. That's other places. It's very external.
Is it the deity?
Relates to it. Very external thing. Because you, I'm bringing this up because you said it's very external. Very external.
The highest place is Krishna. Treat everyone as a
devotee. No, it's other places. That's not Upadeshamrita. Gurus have to travel. Uttama Adhikaris have to travel. That's like Uttama Adhikaris have to be sannyasis. In fact, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told the householder Kurma, you become a guru in your own village.
How happy he is.
How happy he is. Oh, I like that, but no. You have a happiness meter, you know. Well, okay, that's the first verse. That's a general. But how do you distinguish between levels? Steadiness is very nice, but not quite there. I'm telling you, it's very external. Nectar of instructions. Very, very external.
That's the big
thing. Yeah.
Okay, but the first Kanista is what? Kanista is what? That you're supposed to offer within the mind to Kanista. You offer respect within the mind.
No, it's just in the mind.
Respect.
Somebody who's chanting Hare Krishna.
Yeah, anyone who chants.
Anyone who chants Hare Krishna or someone who's received first initiation is considered a Kanista Adhikari and you respect them in your mind. Majjhima Adhikari is who?
One
has received Gayatri Mantra and is?
Fallen.
Engaged in worshipping the deity. Mm-hmm. And the Uttama Adhikari is?
One who is trying to expand the movement.
He's always thinking about how to expand the movement and he's strictly following the process. That's very external. Isn't it? Are you looking there at consciousness? Not much. Those explanations are given elsewhere. But in that verse, in that purport, it's looking at external things. I always wondered why. And I was talking to this devotee from Italy, and he was saying, because beginners can only judge externals. You can't judge anything. You can't judge other things until you're somewhat there yourself. And you're not going to be somewhat there yourself until you've gone through the, until you've already taken diction.
Well, that means there are just external things. There's no substance behind that.
But that's where you have to start something. So there is something external. That's not meaningless. The externals are not meaningless. Somebody who's strictly following the process over a long period of time and always trying to spread the Krishna conscious movement all over the world. That's a very easy thing to judge. That's not a difficult thing to judge. It doesn't require some deep mystic ability to see in somebody's heart to judge them.
I have a question, kind of back to the topic. Sometimes with the, like, trying to develop a relationship with Guru, there's a lot more in reverence than faith. And
which is a good thing?
It's good, but because of that, it stops you from possibly being open with the Guru, so therefore they cannot teach you as well. I'm talking about Diksha Guru.
Well, Diksha Guru doesn't have to give you Shiksha. The Diksha Guru is doing his job even if he doesn't give Shiksha. Generally, Prabhupada says that a person who's giving you Shiksha becomes your Diksha Guru. But generally it works like that, although there's another Gaudiya camp that says the opposite. They say first you get Diksha Guru, then you get Shiksha Guru. It's just like, why do you enroll in a certain university? First, you have some connection, you have some interest. before you decide to enroll. You don't just like take a university out of a hat. You first have some judgment that this place is going to benefit me. But if all the Diksha Guru does is simply bring you into the process and give you the mantras, and if that Diksha Guru is representing the Sampradaya, that's the duty of a Diksha Guru. Diksha Guru can turn you over to other people for personal instruction. That's completely valid. Or Diksha Guru can give you that personal instruction himself. In which case they're acting as both Diksha and Shiksha Guru. And you may have other Shiksha Gurus too. Does that make sense? But there should be some reverence, because the Diksha Guru has done something very special that the Shiksha Guru alone is not doing, generally. And that's putting their name on the line for you. It's the Diksha Guru who has said to Krishna and to all of the rest of the institution, I vouch for this person. When someone comes to a temple and they're initiated, we automatically accept, unless we have this like innocent until proven guilty, we automatically accept, unless there's something really to counteract our impression, that this person is qualified to do various types of services. So if you have first initiation, we immediately assume that you're qualified to do certain services, and if you have second initiation, we immediately assume you're qualified to do certain services. If you have sannyasa initiation, we automatically assume you're qualified to do certain services. On what basis? On the basis that somebody vouched for you. Somebody put their name on the line and said, yeah, you're good. So you owe that person a whole lot. Because that person put their name on the line for you, therefore all the doors in the Sampradaya are open to you in ways that they're not otherwise. Therefore, when you worship the deity, especially your Gayatri mantra allows you to worship the deity, you have to first worship the Diksha Guru. Even if you're mostly getting, we have some devotees who say, well, suppose the Diksha Guru is mostly, you know, they just do the ceremony and your real instruction, your guidance is coming from someone else, doesn't matter. Still, it's that person's picture must be on your altar. Because it's that person who's given you the ability and the right to worship the deity. And that person at the minimum that you have to do is before you worship the deity, you have to worship that person and you have to give that person respect on their Vyas Puja day. That's minimum, bottom line. We had one person writing this whole booklet about how you shouldn't even do that. But that's ungrateful. Then what to speak of if that person is also giving you instruction. You know, and guidance and what to speak of that, then how much gratitude there should be. But even just if they let you into the Sampradaya, it's not a small thing. If you mess up, they get in trouble with Krishna. Right? I mean, Prabhupada would say, he said, the guru suffers if the disciple commits sin. I mean, if the disciple messes up, it's the admissions officer who gets taken to task. Why'd you let this person in? Does that make sense?
No. My point is all that it's not just he's putting his name on the line, he's actually on a daily basis taking the reaction of whatever you're doing wrong and whatever you're not, the promises you're not fulfilling. And
Well, he's putting his name on the line on an ongoing basis.
Ongoing, whether
you accept or not. I mean, I had that experience myself that I was accepted into a master's program, and 2 months into the program, one of my professors invited me to move up to the PhD program. And that was an unheard of thing to do in that department. And he happened to be the temporary dean of the whole school of education at that time. So basically, the other professors said, they had to all vote on it, but everyone else told me, hey, if he says you're in, you're in. But I felt a great obligation to this person the rest of the time I was in the program that I had to make it. He really extended himself for me. He put his name on the line. It was a number of things were very clear to me with that. That when he said it, the institution accepted what he said, even though what he did was not exactly according to the rules. We sort of bent the rules a little bit. Now, not any professor could have done that. some new assistant professor couldn't have said, well, you can do this, and the university would have said, sure, whatever you want. But this guy was a big enough professor that if he said it, everybody else went along, all the other professors and the university itself. And they changed everything in the computer. So I saw that. That was quite interesting. But then also I had an obligation. If I messed up, that would look bad for him. Now, I also had classes with other professors. He wasn't my only professor. But everything else I did, I was working under his guidance. And he became my main advisor for my dissertation, and it was quite interesting because I got some stuff from another professor at another university. And when that professor saw, oh, you've got, you know, Dr. Fenwick English as your advisor, she said, oh, I want you to come speak at this big gathering of educators. She said, you have Fenwick English as your advisor. He's one of the top educators in the country. So you become known. I'm this person's disciple. And it was interesting that not only then are the doors open within your own institution, they're open within other institutions. Then I had professors from other institutions who also helped me. You become a recognized student, even the gurus in the other sampradayas. It's not that Lord Shiva then is going to reject you. When you're in the Brahma sampradaya, you know, you can go to hell. You saw? Yes.
I feel like from this discussion, it's really important to get a picture.
It's not that going back to God it is impossible without Diksha, but it's a very risky proposition.
So, with that in mind, then, what, basically, a lot of people say that the Diksha Guru just comes, you just know, it's like, no, you just know, you just know.
Open the door one day and there he is.
So,
maybe.
There's that whole, you know, Cinderella kind of thing going on. What happens if you're waiting for that?
You might be waiting a long time.
Yeah, and if you actually miss your job.
Well, it's just like you see this happens with marriage too, you know. If people, like, when people just hope for a love marriage and they're just kind of hoping that the person's just gonna show up at their door sometime. Sometimes you have to be a little aggressive.
And look,
you know, I mean if I want to find a suitable wife for my son or a suitable husband for my daughter, I can't just like sit at home. I'm just going to sit at home in front of my altar and just chant. Krishna's a nice wife for my son. I mean, maybe that'll work. It worked for Pradhara Muni. He just prayed and David Ruchi showed up, you know. But generally, you have to be a little aggressive and you have to look. And you have to say, you know, hey, do you know of any nice girls? Does that... Oh, there are any nice gurus? There's so many people in the Hare Krishna movement who could be your guru.
That's the problem. There's so many.
There's too many, huh?
Yeah, so many, like, why don't they just, like, in awe of everybody and then take, like, 50 years?
Well, then it certainly wouldn't be a problem. You know, just pick one of them.
So, I mean, if I miss my chance of getting diksha, if it's the most important thing to get diksha, then why can I not just go and just take on
diksha? Well, yeah, you can take anyone you know is representing the Sampradaya. Now, if you also want that person to have a shiksha relationship with you, then that may be something different. Then you may be looking at other things. Because someone who's going to give you shiksha, you may be looking at where is this person located geographically. If the main preaching they do is in Japan, then it may be a little difficult for me to get shiksha from this person. Then you may be looking at, you know, can I relate to this person? Maybe I find somebody that I have full faith that they're representing the Sampradaya and that if they give me diksha that I'll also be accepted by Krishna. That they're not just pocketing the money. You know, that I recognize they're a bona fide representative of the Sampradaya. But maybe I don't feel personally that much inspired by them. Maybe I just don't connect with them as a person. You know, you may see a girl and think, well, she'd be a lovely wife, but not for me. Does that make sense? But that depends what kind of relationship you want to have with that person. And they have to accept you too, you know. It's not like you can just say, well, hey, you're my guru. That's one of the main things that's wrong with the Ritric philosophy. They have to accept you. But it depends what you're looking for. But you'd have to talk to that person and say, you know, well, what is our relationship going to be?
Mm-hmm.
In general. In general. I mean, most of the people who give diksha assume that they're also going to be giving you shiksha. In some cases, though, they're not. I mean, in some cases, they'll tell you very frankly, I'm sorry, I have already 3,000 disciples. I travel a lot. Do not expect very much personal shiksha from me. And if you're willing to have a relationship with me, where basically I'm your diksha guru, and I'm giving general instructions to my disciples, and you can sit and listen to my classes, but I'm not going to really get to know you personally, and I'm not going to give you very much personal instruction, and if you're happy with that, fine. Right? Is that correct? So that has to be established. What are you looking for? I don't think it's that hard to find somebody who's representing the Sampradaya properly. That's not that hard.
What means if you die before you've got the... What means if you die before you've got a guru and teacher, and in your next life, do you start, do you get your cooking?
Don't worry about it. I have to make sure I get married before I die, so I'm just going to pull some girl off the street and marry her because I don't want to, you know, I want to make sure I don't lose out. You know. You've got to do it right. I mean, I'm just remembering that my daughter at a certain point, there was one boy we were looking at, and then she decided she didn't want to marry. She was 18 and she really wanted to get married. And I said, well, if you decide you don't want to go with this boy, who knows, maybe years before he finds someone. She said, well, it's okay. She said, but I really want to get married. I said, well, I'm not just going to go grab some guy off the street. You know, it has to be done properly.
That is what people do at 26. You get ready
to marry if you have time. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, it's got to be...
No one gets second initiation. No one starts the initiation until 20. You don't see that 15 get initiated.
You can.
In London.
You can. I mean, Prabhupada said it's by 12. I mean, my personal feeling is that it's probably best to wait till you're 18 to take initiation. But Prabhupada said you can get it at age 12. And the reason that I would suggest waiting till one is 18 is that I've seen people take initiation younger, and then when their problems came up, they say, well, I was too young to make the decision, and I didn't know what I was doing, etc., etc., etc. And I would just rather not see people be able to make those kind of excuses. But that's a personal advice for time, place, and circumstance. Shastrically, you can take initiation when you're 12.
Just on some of the points you were saying, this example of Srila Prabhupada, when he was traveling around, and the main instruction that the devotees got was to hearing, they heard lectures.
Just hearing classes, right?
Hearing classes, reading,
but what that meant is that we really had other people as our shiksha gurus. We didn't think of it like that at the time, but that was the reality.
But diksha, although you're saying that, you know, diksha is kind of just someone who connects.
Well, that's not a just.
That's a big
jump. That's huge.
Huge.
That's huge, but because everything else depends upon that.
The process of finding a diksha guru is through the process of hearing.
Generally. Prabhupada says generally the shiksha guru later on becomes the diksha guru.
Otherwise I don't understand the difference between there are
generally.
In the Indian community, many people will come who say they were initiated at some point, when they were younger, and they have to come to you, you know, like this. So they have a guru that they never see, they never hear from, they never, you know.
Well, the diksha guru also has a responsibility.
We actually tell them, no, that's not.
Well, but there's also, you may be looking at, there's an upanayana, which is the giving of the sacred thread and Brahma Gayatri, which is a whole other discussion. But it's the responsibility of the diksha guru to make sure you get diksha. You don't enroll somebody in university and then you just drop them off a cliff. You know, either you've got to take care of them personally, or you've got to make sure somebody's taking care of them. So there has to be some arrangement for shiksha. But Prabhupada says, generally speaking, you first establish a relationship with someone as your shiksha guru, and then you ask that person for shiksha. But that's the general process.
Doesn't he say it's the most prominent shiksha? So not necessarily the first person you get shiksha from.
It's a hard thing. You can't make a... It's a very individual heart thing.
In general, if you can get this from somebody who's really can relate to, would they not logically be the person who can shift from their life because they resonate with Krishna?
Possibly. This is very individual. You can't fit this into a formula. You can fit into a formula for you, but you can't put your formula into somebody else.
I'm
going to
give initiations in the future.
Me? I had about 10 people who were asking me years ago. And then there's an institutional process right now in ISKCON to get permission to give diksha. So I started to go through that process, and if you get 3 or more people objecting, then it has to go to the GBC body. So 3 people objected, and they said, we don't object to her personally, but we don't think women should give diksha. We're not sure of these. So then when it was brought up to the GBC meeting, they said, well, we don't want to think about this particular person right now. Let's just look at the principle as to whether or not we're going to have women giving diksha. So they asked a group of devotees to study it, which they did, and prepared a paper, which they gave to the GBC at the next year. And the GBC approved that paper, which I said you can read on Dandavas, showing both philosophically and historically that women have given diksha, although far less. Actually, some devotees went through a count and found like the 20% of diksha gurus have been. Maybe think women are 50% of the population. But prominent women diksha gurus are very rare. Anyway, then they decided that, and for various reasons, nobody brought up me when they made that decision. And when my UBC man came back, I said, so what did they decide about me? And he said, well, we never discussed you. And I was like, okay. So, and what I did was I really encouraged the people who were waiting to go elsewhere. And a number of them did, at which point I decided it was a good thing that I had encouraged them to go elsewhere. I still have some people who are waiting, but I wouldn't say any of them are like the most terribly serious people in the world. So they can wait. So then this next year I said to my GBC man, I said, you know, I still have these people who are waiting, and would you bring up my name this year? He said, but now you're moving. So the way the GBC system is right now is you have to get permission from your local preaching area. And the reason you get permission from your local preaching are 2 reasons. One, they figure that people in your local preaching area will know whether or not you're a nonsense, which is not always true. I mean, all the people on that committee, a lot of them didn't know me at all. And the other, because it was from the zone, and parts of that zone I never went to. And the other reason is that they only want people to make disciples in their zone who are friendly with all of the managers. It's an institutional managerial consideration. They don't want someone coming in their zone making disciples and then giving them instructions opposite to that of the temple leaders or stealing them out of the temple. So the idea is that the local people are supposed to approve that whoever can make disciples in my zone is somebody that we like and we trust. So my GBC said, well, now you're moving from America, so what is the point of having a local committee? And he said, in any way, a lot of those people who are on that committee aren't in the zone anymore. He said, now you're going to have to wait till you go someplace else and then ask there. So I'm like, okay. So that's where it stands at the present moment.
Where is your base at the moment?
I don't have one. Probably more London than anything, but I don't have one. So that complicates matters. And it may be Vrindavan, and I would never, ever, would they ever, they don't even let women get by with him class. Okay. So that will never happen. There's a number of women in the Vrindavan area who are acting as shiksha gurus for a lot of people. Prashanta, Srimati, I mean, Narayani. Narayani is probably one of the greatest Bhagavatam scholars in the whole of ISKCON. And I see there, I mean, I saw with Prashanta that people were coming and offering obeisances to her, men, women. That was sort of interesting. But at this point, you know, it's like, okay, Krishna, if I get a group of really serious people who refuse to go elsewhere and are, you know, begging me for years and then all again go through the process, if they still have the same process. But I'm happy that Krishna used me to bring up the concept of women giving diksha. And if that's all he used me for in that regard, that's okay.
So it's okay.
Yeah.
In general.
You know, as far as what I'm going to pray, I don't know, whatever Krishna wants me to do. It's a big responsibility, and it's not like when I'm jumping up and down to have. It's a really big responsibility. I already have a number of people who regularly come to me for shiksha, and even that is a very big responsibility. Some of the things they ask me is just like, do I really want to take on full responsibility for disciples? I don't know. It's real heavy. And especially because people expect the Diksha Guru to be God. They expect you to meet all their emotional needs and everything that's in their heart and chalk out a plan for their life where they'll never suffer from the body, mind, other living entities or the weather, you know, and it's just not going to happen. And there's all these unrealistic expectations put on the Guru. I mean, I really like in fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, many, many lives you and I have passed, I remember all of them, but you do not. And Prabhupada says very clearly in the purport, there's a difference between even the liberated living entity and Krishna. Even the liberated living entity may not remember all their past lives. But there's this, you know, very, very high, unrealistic. So I don't really know if I want to be involved with people who are playing that sort of game. It's not terribly attractive. The devotees who do that service are very surrendered devotees. That they're willing to do that service for Prabhupada and for the movement. It's the most difficult service to do. Yeah.
I've heard this notion that we're supposed to test the group.
It's not just a notion, it's a Shastra conjunction.
but I imagine that there's some guidance given as to, because it can't just be...
Well, yeah, again, how do you know somebody is a bona fide policeman? How do you know somebody is a bona fide professor? You test them. Right? How do you test them? How do you know somebody's a bona fide policeman?
No, not
either. It's similar. How do you know?
Ask
for a badge. You can check with the department. You can call the department. Does this guy work for you? Is the person in Parampara? Do they have a guru? Or are they just independent? You know, do they say, I went out to the desert and I meditated and I got revelations and now I'm now a guru? There's a lot of people like that, isn't there? They have to have a... And are they following? Are they a good disciple? The main qualification to be a guru is to be a good disciple. And then are they mature? Are they a mature disciple? You know, you don't have a professor who's just in their freshman year. You have a professor or someone who's graduated. It should be someone who's mature. So what do we say? For beginners, it's very simple. They're strictly following the process. Can you see if they're strictly following the process? Is it that hard to see? Are they chanting their end? Now, obviously, you can't watch somebody 24 hours a day. And if somebody really wants to sneak and do something, they can find a way to do it. But still, reasonable. Right? Within reason. Are they following the process? It confirms you. And how, have they been following the process for a month? Well, then probably they're not so mature. I mean, maybe. It's possible. You could become fully realized in a minute. But I wouldn't suggest that, you know, someone's just taken diksha a month ago and then you say, okay, I'm going to... It should be some maturity. And there's symptoms in the Bhagavad Gita of one who transcended the modes of material nature, if you want to go to that level. There's symptoms in Chaitanya Charitamrita of somebody who's at the stage of bhava, if you're looking for that. And those are discernible symptoms. Can you be fooled? Well, yeah. But you can't be so paralyzed. It's like, you know, again, somebody, they never want to get married because might be a problem. I know of one astrologer devotee who never got married because he always look at the chart and he could always find something wrong with that woman. You know? So, again, you're not looking for God. The guru's not God. You're not looking for someone who can walk on water and read minds. It's not what you're looking for. You're looking for somebody that when they say they've accepted you, that means Krishna's accepted you. That's what you're looking for. And someone who can either give you proper instruction themselves or who can connect you with somebody you can. So that when they say you're in, you're in. That's what you're looking for. It's not a very complicated thing to find. You don't need to set the bar all the way up there. Now, do you have to have some connection with a prema bhakta? Yes. But that's not hard either. We have connection with so many devotees of prema, don't we? So many. Because as soon as you're into the Sampradaya, then all of the acharyas accept you. It's not that, well, you know, I've got to be, my Diksha Guru has got to be at the highest level of Mahabhav. As soon as you're, if you're in, you're in. Prabhupada's also then accepted you. Bhakti Sanatha's accepted you. Narada Muni's accepted you. Madhvacharya's accepted you. And the person who delivers you, who takes you back to God? Who's the only person who can deliver you?
Chaitanya.
Yes, Krishna. He's the only one who can sign the diploma. No jiva can deliver you. Even Shiva can't deliver you. What to speak of a jiva? But when the jiva recommends you, then Krishna delivers you. Because Krishna is neutral. Because your professor recommended you, I recommend this person, Krishna says, okay. But it's Krishna who delivers you. He said, you must have contact with the Paramahansa, but that's there. Well, there's no problem for that. Does that make sense? There's no problem to have contact with the Paramahansa. There's so many Paramahansa. And we have so many members of our movement who are very, very, very realized, whether they're bhava or prema, I don't know. But they're very realized. Isn't it? Yes.
But a lot of the reason why people come into Krishna consciousness is because, from what I've heard and spoken to people about, is because they're trying to fill a gap in their life. They've got questions that they want answering when they're missing something.
Mm-hmm.
And so they come into Krishna consciousness, and obviously eventually they'll be aspiring to the Guru.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously they want those answers from the Guru, or they want those answers to be cleared by the Guru. You're saying that the Guru can't always answer that, like, it can't always help you with your emotions and your answers and everything.
Well, but you're talking about two completely different things.
But is it not the same thing? No. What they're trying to strive for, Krishna.
No. Well, but that's Krishna. The Guru gives you Krishna, but the Guru is not Krishna. Prabhupada says that if a Guru says to you, I'm your best friend, then they're a cheater. They say Krishna is your best friend. The Guru is your best friend because they're giving you the Krishna. But the Guru doesn't try to be your best friend. The Guru tries to give you Krishna as your best friend.
As a representative of Krishna.
But the Guru cannot be Krishna. Krishna becomes whatever you want to worship him. You want to worship him as your father, your son, your lover, your friend. He becomes that. The Guru's not going to do that. The Guru is not going to become your friend or your father or your lover or your husband or your man. No. You know, the need we have for these things is not going to be fulfilled by the Guru. Not directly. Indirectly, by giving you Krishna. But not directly. The relationship with the Guru is generally formal. It's that of a teacher and student. I mean, you may feel that some of your teachers are your friends. Like after I graduated, I said to my main professor, I said, well, I guess you're my friend. He said, well, I'm your mentor. He's a mentor friend. It's not a friend like Chidi Shakti's my friend. It's not my buddy. So, he's my mentor. He's my teacher. We're friendly. You follow? We're not inimical. If I write him now an email and ask him for advice, he'll answer me. If I needed some help with my career or something, I'm sure he would help me. He's not like my buddy. I mean, there's sometimes that someone becomes a very intimate servant of their guru. But then they have to be careful. Because if you become too close and too familiar and too buddy, then you may damage the relationship. But the guru answering all of your questions and bringing you to spiritual fulfillment is not the same thing as meeting our human emotional needs and our human social needs. And the guru is not, you know, somebody that I socialize with. And people deal like that. You know, they write. One devotee in the movement who's acting as guru, we were discussing these things. He said, you know, you really got to watch what people do. And he sent me a letter with the name taken out from one of his disciples. And then he said, and this is from a man, !! Things like, you know, whenever you walk in the room, Guru Dave, my heart is melting, and you light up the whole atmosphere, and, you know, all the sentimental, mushy-gushy stuff. And I'll tell you, the people acting as gurus, they revolted by this stuff, but they tolerated for the good of the disciples. They don't usually say to the disciples, you know, this is really nauseating. They just say, oh, thank you very much for your devotion. And they think, well, here's some unified person offering their devotion. And they just take it. But it's very unpalatable, actually. When people are thinking, well, this person's now going to be my, you know, they're going to meet all of my emotional and social needs. The hole in our heart is to be filled by Krishna, and Guru helps us to fill that hole. Does that make sense? Yes.
How do we know if we satisfy the Guru?
He smiles at you? He writes you a letter and says, I'm happy. He's with you and he says, thank you very much for doing this. And you should know what the Guru's mission is. You know, obviously, everybody who's a guru in ISKCON shares Prabhupada's mission, and then also there's different individual missions. Are you helping furthering that mission? I mean, again, it's not that difficult of a thing, and Prabhupada will often say that if you please your immediate authority, you know, are you pleasing your husband? Are you pleasing the temple president? Are you pleasing the temple commander? Are you pleasing the GBC? Now, that isn't always. Gadadhar Pandit was once chastised by the devotees, although he pleased Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But generally speaking, how do you know the president of the company is pleased with you? Because you're a foreman is pleased with you. So we try to please each other. I mean, if you guys are happy with me, then I assume the Prabhupada's happy with me. Seriously. It's like they asked me to give class on Janmashtami, and when people came up to me and said, oh, I was a helpful class, I can understand Prabhupada's happy with me because I'm serving his devotees. I mean, it's not like rocket science. Are you following the process? That's a pretty simple thing. If you're chanting your 16 rounds, are you following the regulative principles? Are you attending Mangal Artik? Are you studying the books? Are you preaching? Are you concocting some weird thing? It's pretty simple. And you'll feel spiritual satisfaction. You may not necessarily always feel material satisfaction. Your body will sometimes get sick. Your mind will sometimes feel sad. It will sometimes rain. The other devotees may sometimes yell at you. If you feel spiritually happy, that's a different quality. The other is the modes going up and down. And that's true even with the mind. The mind is sometimes feeling full of energy and joyful, and the mind is sometimes feeling sluggish and depressed. That's the way the world is. But there's a spiritual happiness that can be there even if your body is in pain, even if your mind is depressed, even if the other devotees are yelling at you, and it's raining out, and you have no money in the bank. You can still feel spiritually happy, isn't it? Yeah. You can feel Krishna's gone away and he's mad at you too. You feel very bad. You said it, everything? Yes.
When the spiritual master is not physically present and the disciple sees him, the spiritual master has to come back and rectify and bring the soul back.
Yes. It can also, doesn't have to come always personally. Like Govind Mangala Thakur, he had a stage to detain Bhava. Then he took another birth, and in his next birth, he was born in a Brahmin family, but he became degraded. And it said his guru from his previous life spoke through his girlfriend Chintamani. But the guru still has responsibility. Now, how the guru decides to fulfill that responsibility, that's an individual thing. But the guru's responsibility doesn't end just because they're no longer on the planet. Yes?
This is one final question. A lot of us are facing, or we're having contact with people who call themselves mystics. So can you clarify just so that we understand really clearly as to what
okay, so you've fallen in love with some singer, some beautiful female singer, and you're just in love with her, and you put her poster up on your wall, and you declare undying love to her poster. Now, could you tell people that you were married to her?
Probably could. But yeah.
You could. What's wrong with that? But, I mean, what makes it unbonafide? Why can't you just decide that you've married her? What has to happen? She has to accept you. Maybe she doesn't like you. So it's pretty simple. Again, I mean, can you just say, well, I think Cambridge is a really nice university. I think I'm going to be a student there. What's wrong with that picture? They have to do what? They have to accept you. It's a mutual thing. The guru also tests you, you know, not just that you're testing the guru. The guru tests you too. And a guru who doesn't test you is not doing his duty. You know, the acceptance is a mutual thing. How can these people say, well, Prabhupada's accepted you? Yes, if you take Diksha, Prabhupada will accept you. Absolutely, yes. As I say, you become immediately accepted by the whole Sampradaya. You become a disciple of everyone in the Sampradaya. But there's a process.
But the thing qualified will accept by what he said in the message.
Well, that's interesting. Because Prabhupada's not going to say something in one letter that contradicts all the Shastra and all the tradition. And if he did, he wouldn't be a bona fide guru, by the way. He can't just make up his own parampara process. We accept Prabhupada as a bona fide guru not only because we see his personal realization, but because he's coming in a bona fide sampradaya. And he's repeating the word of scriptures, not just something sentimental, you know. Oh, we see he's blowing a certain wattage. You know, there's guru, sadhu, and shastra. So yeah, there's a process. A Prabhupada gives the example, just like when you get married. So you're married. So you're also connected with your husband's family, right? Okay? As soon as you marry someone, and you're immediately related to so many people. But there's a process for getting married. There's a certain process. You can't just say, well, I think I'm in love with so-and-so, and therefore I'm related to their whole family. Yeah, there's a certain process by which you understand that somebody's accepted you. They have to say they've accepted you. They can't say it through somebody else. They have to say it directly. I mean, sometimes they perform marriage by proxy, but that's pretty weird. I mean, it does sometimes happen. But even then, the person in a distant place has said that they accept it. I know sometimes European royalty has done that. But still, the guy in the other country is saying, I can't be there for the wedding, I'm going to have someone stand in for me, but I still accept her as my wife. Isn't that weird? Yeah. It's really weird. That's weird. So why don't we think it's weird with Guru? You know, you've got to hear directly from the Guru that the Guru has accepted you. You can't tell. I mean, why on such an important thing would you trust that?
In having said that, it's not the general case that is weird. That still says that sometimes it's possible.
Yeah, but in that case, when it's done, just like Prabhupada, I got first initiation through a letter, but I still got the letter from Prabhupada. Prabhupada wasn't sitting on the asana when I had the fire jug in. But I got the letter from Prabhupada. Yeah. Otherwise, it becomes entirely speculative. Well, I got it in a dream, or, you know, I got some vision, or... I mean, we could say that in theory such things might be possible, but that's such a wild and unusual and remote situation, and basically it just doesn't, it's not the way things are done. You know, I mean, when I got second initiation, I was with Prabhupada personally. So then there was no question, I mean, he was right there. He was telling me the guy through mantra, he's sitting on the altar. Even then someone else performed this fire jug, he was sitting on the altar. But for first initiation, he wasn't. He was in the other city, but I had the letter. It wasn't just that my temple president, Sri Govinda, said, well, I think Prabhupada has accepted you. What he could say was, I've decided that I'm going to recommend you to Srila Prabhupada for acceptance. He could say that, but he couldn't say, well, Prabhupada has accepted you. I could say, well, I'm going to recommend you to this nice boy that you should marry. But I can't tell you whether or not the boy's accepted you. I can't make it, I can't say, well, he's definitely going to accept you. You can already assume you're married. How can I say that? That's outrageous. What, does that make sense?
How can Guru accept you if he doesn't marry you?
It's his duty to marry you. It's his Shastric duty. Whether or not you're a fit candidate. Now, if he can choose to delegate that to somebody. But he has to make sure it gets done. He has to. He's putting his name on the line to Krishna that you're a fit candidate. He better know whether or not you are. Otherwise, it's an offense. Giving the holy name to the faithless is particularly an offense for Guru. That offense particularly applies to someone who acts as Guru, according to Bhaktivinoda. I mean, it can apply to anybody if we're giving instruction to somebody who's not receptive. Yeah. Just the same thing. Go to a university. The admissions officer had better make sure that there's a good chance that you're going to be a good student. Because then you're representing, as soon as you're a student, you're representing the university now, aren't you? People are going to judge the university by your behavior. And why should they waste all this time giving all this facility and instruction to somebody who's just going to party and just going to drop out? That's a waste of the resources of the university. It's an insult to all the professors. It's insulting to the professors if the admission officer fills their classes with useless people. So yeah, they're supposed to judge. You know, they look at your test scores, they look at your interview, they look at your essay. So they're supposed to see. I mean, what Prabhupada asked us to do as a judge is you already start following the process, and you should be following the process for at least 6 months to a year to show that you're serious. And either he would test people directly or he would and delegate them. And Prabhupada would get very angry if child presidents were recommending people who weren't fit. You know, he'd really chew me out. You can't do that. The ideal situation is personal. where you're personally testing the guru and the guru is personally testing the disciple. That's the, according to Shastra, that's the ideal situation. It says you should personally test for 1 year.
Didn't Prabhupada have people that weren't ready? They didn't even know of the four eggs.
Sometimes, especially in the very beginning. Generally not. And especially not once this movement was established. It would be very unusual. Sometimes. In the very beginning, Prabhupada was taking a risk. But he was taking a risk. You know, and that's not like the standard operating procedure. Sometimes in an unusual circumstance, you may take some risk. But generally, no. I'm just saying this one devotee in Bombay, who, the way he found out about the movement, he was in jail for the zillionth time in his life for stealing. He'd grown up a street boy. He didn't know his parents. He didn't even know his name. He would adopt different names according to circumstances. And I heard him tell his own story like this. So he was in jail and he saw back the Godhead magazine and he saw a picture of Prabhupada and he saw that Prabhupada was wearing a nice watch. And he thought, well, when I get out of jail, I'm going to find this man and steal his watch. So when he got out of jail, he inquired where the temple was. And he asked the devotees if Prabhupada were there and they said no. But they engaged him in service and so he started doing some service. They said, don't worry, he'll be coming soon. So he was just waiting for Prabhupada to come so he could steal his watch. So meanwhile, he's engaging in service, and this was in Bombay when the temple was just starting, and the devotees were living in just poverty, and, you know, it was really difficult, but he said for him it was like heaven, because he'd never even lived in a building before, he'd always just lived in the street. So to him it was like really nice facility, he had a roof over his head, and he had hot meals, and this kind of thing, you know. And after some time, Vishakha taught him how to chant on beads, and gave him some beads, and he was chanting, but basically the devotees considered him unfit. You know, he didn't even speak English. He didn't even speak Hindi. He only spoke, what is it, in Maharashtra? Marathi. Yeah. And for a long time, even after he joined the temple, he would still steal. Yeah, he was saying that he had a problem with it because he was so habituated to steal. But of course, he would go out and steal stuff for the deities. But still, he was stealing. But for a while, he was stealing the deities' money because they'd give him sometimes money to go out and buy things. And what happened is if they didn't give him enough money, he'd steal from passerbys to get enough money to buy stuff for the deities. But also sometimes if they gave him too much, he would use the money for his own purposes. And then Jagat Prabhu one time caught him and chastised him and he gave up that habit. But it took him a few years, he said. It took him like 2-3 years before he fully gave up stealing. Anyway, so at one point they told him that Prabhupada was going to be nearby. He got really excited. He said, I want to go see Prabhupada. And the town president didn't want him to go. And he was so insistent, so finally he let him go. And when he went to see Prabhupada, you know, he goes in and offers obeisances, and Prabhupada says, what can I do for you? And he said, well, Prabhupada, he said, frankly, he said, I came originally to steal your watch. So Prabhupada, he said, that's all right, I don't want him. And Prabhupada asked him to stay with him, and he said, well, no, he said, I promised my town president that I'd only stay for 3 days. He said, that was the only way I was let out of the temple. Prabhupada said, then you must go back. Anyway, at one point when Prabhupada was giving initiations in Bombay, he was washing pots in the kitchen. He was all, you know, when you wash pots, you get all black from the bottom of the pots. He was filthy. And he asked, he'd already been in the movement 2 or 3 years at that point. And he asked the head of the kitchen, what's Prabhupada doing? They said, don't you know he's giving initiations? And he said, well, I want to go see. They said, no, you have to work in the kitchen. He said, well, I really want to go see. Said, all right, you can go for 10 minutes, then you have to come back. So he goes into the temple room where Prabhupada's doing the jagging. Prabhupada sees him, and he motions him. He said, you sit down. And then Prabhupada calls him up, and he says, so, how many rounds do you chant? Says, what are the regulations? Says, I don't know. What did you do? No meeting. And then he says, oh, yes. Prabhupada said, you follow him? He said, yes. Prabhupada said, what is your name? He said, I really don't know. Prabhupada, I've had so many names. I don't even know what my name. He said, but the devotees in the temple called me Haridas. I said, all right. He said, Prabhupada says, where's your beads? He said, oh, I left them in the kitchen. Prabhupada took his own beads. And he's still a very nice man. One time he said that when he was out, he bought some chocolate and he had it hidden in his bead bag. And when he went past Prabhupada's room, he offered a basin of peace and the chocolate fell out. Prabhupada picked it up and looking at it, and he said, "What is this?" And I said, "What are you doing that in this?" He said, "Why are you eating this?" He said, "Prabhupada, I like sweets." Prabhupada said, "Oh, you like sweets." So that night, Prabhupada made challah for him. He invited him, gave him a challah. Sometimes, yes, we might initiate somebody who appears to be unqualified. But especially in the beginning, especially the first year or so, Prabhupada was very liberal. He was basically just taking a chance. You know, anybody who looked like they were even remotely interested, then he would accept them as his disciples. I mean, one example of that is Mukunda Maharaj. Mukunda was one of the first people who found Prabhupada at the temple at 22nd Avenue. He was coming to Prabhupada's Valley, and he helped arrange Prabhupada in 22nd Avenue. And he was coming, and I believe he was in the first group of people to get initiated. He and his wife, and then he and his wife had the first marriage that Prabhupada performed. And of course, his wife's sister is Jamuna, who came to prepare the wedding feast. So, but they didn't take it that seriously. You know, it wasn't, he didn't take it that seriously. At a certain point, he left. I think he wanted to go do some, he was a musician. The reason he left New York and he was going to Oregon, he wanted to do something with his music and stuff. But instead he ended up going to San Francisco and he was telling people about Prabhupada and talking to people about the movement. And he got about 50 people who were interested in Krishna consciousness, and he arranged for Prabhupada to chant at this, he arranged actually a whole hippie gathering with rock music, and he was pulling in the biggest musicians of the time, and he also had a slot for Prabhupada to chant. And then he contacted Prabhupada. Prabhupada did not tell him to go to San Francisco. He just left on his own, you know, whatever he wanted to do. And he contacted Prabhupada and said, you know, I've got these people in San Francisco and we have this concert where you can come and perform if you'd like to come. And Prabhupada wanted to go. And the devotees in New York said, you can't go there. It's just, you know, all these rock people and who knows what they'll be doing. But Prabhupada wanted to go. So he went, he gets off the plane. There's 50 people to greet him, none of whom other than Mukunda had ever met him before. And they all greet him and they're all chanting Hare Krishna. You know, and then they had this big concert where the musicians agreed to play just for cost. It was all donated, so, you know, I think the temple got thousands of dollars. And basically started a temple in San Francisco. But he was going up and down in his following. And then after that, he kind of left for a while, and his wife had trust on him. And it was a long time before he was, like, really fixed in following. But just see, Prabhupada took that chance in initiating him, and he started a second temple by himself. So that was he took a chance, and in some cases it really paid off. In other cases it didn't, but he was... Is that all right? We should stop now, or you're all going to kill me for going so long. Does anybody have any, like, urgent, pressing, dying to ask something? Haribo, nice to see you again. You working really hard?
Well, yeah, trying.
Yes, just have somebody else then. Not me. Somebody with a sweet voice. Does this deal with a lot of your, like, basic questions? Is this helpful? Okay. I should say that as a member of the Shastric Advisory Council, one of the things that I've researched the most over the years has been all these questions about Guru. I've ended up really studying them in depth, in depth, in depth, in depth, in depth. Are there any strong disagreements with anything that's said? Question?
I have a quick clarification. I know you've been describing two systems of how to become a guru.
Two?
Well, you should have the tragic one, and then put the one that what's happening within Islam right now. What you were describing, I thought was a tragic, and I don't know if you described the Islam much, but I didn't.
I did when she was asking whether or not I'm taking disciples, and I described the ISKCON, because she only wanted to know the Shastra.
Yeah.
ISKCON is, the ISKCON leaders are trying to come to grips with how to manage a worldwide institution, which has not been done before. So they're trying to balance the credibility of the institution with the traditional practice. And I don't, as far as I don't believe that there's anybody presently on the GBC who thinks that the present system is exactly what it should be. But they're trying to figure out how to, basically how to keep the credibility of the institution. And if we did things in just a traditional way, there's a lot of concern that maybe the institutional credibility would be hampered. I believe we'll come to the traditional way, but it may be some to figure out how to do that on an international scale is not going to be so easy. We're getting closer. These are questions, you know, what exactly should be the process in which there is not a consensus at this point? What should be the institutional process? All right? Somebody chant? Yeah, that's my problem. I do too much talking and singing on Janmashtami Vyas Puja. I don't want to sing right now. If I do, then I won't be able to talk for the next couple of days. And I didn't bring any throat drops with me. Do you have anything that you want to add or any corrections?
No.
I'm trying to demystify the process, you know. It becomes this mystical, woo. Ready? Yes, exactly. They're looking for some fireworks and rather than the bhakti and the purity.
So you like saying how it's better because then you don't get let down from it.
If you understand things from the get-go, then your faith should be solid over the long term. You know, if you're expecting somebody with fireworks who walks on water, and then you try to, and then you ask them to walk on water, and they can't do it, and then you say, well, I guess they're not a bona fide guru. Or they ask you to do a certain service, and it isn't all just hearts and flowers, and you don't say, well, I'm going to reject my guru now because I did the service and it still rained. It was still a hurricane, you know, even though I did the service.